The very fact that I knew this as an essentially insignificant, unimportant person, highly paid, I was GS-18, I came in as, because of my earlier work as a consultant. It was a raise from my RAND salary, actually. From work that I had been expert on, actually, the nuclear work, into a field I was not expert but wanted to learn. So this was kind of an apprenticeship within the government. No impact on the policy process, and yet a very good window on what was being said, which meant that I knew critical, crucial things bearing on the issue of war and peace, which not one senator and not one representative was allowed to know, and on the contrary, about which each one of them, chairman of committees, was lied to and successfully lied to. A wider war was on the way. Now, I have another odd thing worth noting about this was, after my trip to Vietnam 1 week in 61, and then having stayed away from it deliberately, because I didn't want the kind of taint that people had gotten from being associated with the Bay of Pigs. I was no expert on Vietnam, but as I mentioned in the book, I heard somewhere, maybe somebody can give me the reference, you don't have to be an ichthyologist to know when a fish stinks. And Vietnam was not something I really wanted, but to study, all right. I believe specifically that the bombing campaign that was being planned underway and the targets that were hit on August 4th were targets that were part of a 94 target list that had been selected months earlier, just as the Tonkin Gulf Resolution had been drafted months earlier and waited for the appropriate time, the appropriate provocation that would justify getting this blank check through Congress. Now, to call it a blank check because it said the president was authorized to take all necessary measures as he determined to prevent, among other things, further aggression in Southeast Asia. A check can only be cashed once, so that's a misleading metaphor. It was an unlimited line of credit. The total delegation to the president. And people asked at the time, doesn't this mean that the president could send divisions over there? And Fulbright, who was shepherding this through for the president, said, well, actually, yes, it does say that. The language is that broad. But I assure you that this president will not take any such action. First, doesn't intend any such action, which was this, well, that's another story, but and will not take such an action without coming back to Congress for explicit, immediate, further authorization. On that assurance, all but two senators, although many of them had doubts and worries and skepticism about it, but all but two, Morris and Gruning, voted yes for that delegation for domestic political reasons, largely. The Democrats voted to get the Republicans on record behind our president, take the issue away from Goldwater, show a bipartisan support for the president at that time, before the election of 64. And because, okay. I was asked just recently when I told a story like this by an interviewer, weren't you shocked in what all these lies? And I said, no, I'd been a consultant for years. I'd seen a lot of lies in the government. In fact, Harrison Salisbury once wrote in a book about the Pentagon Papers, it was the lies that got Ellsberg finally. And I remember writing a long set of corrections to him. I said, are you kidding? I couldn't have been in the government if you can't stand lying, I couldn't have been an official for a week, let alone for years, as I was. If you don't understand all the reasons for lying, all the need for it, all the need for secrecy. Now, the secrecy is justified in their minds, especially by the need to keep secrets, information from foreign enemies, especially in wartime, but even other countries, other states. And there is that reason, which accounts for, I don't know how you'd measure exactly, 1%, 2%, 5% of the secrecy. The rest of it is to keep secrets from other agencies in the executive branch, from rivals for power, from Congress above all, from the budget committees, from people who control the budget. From other services, the enemy. The Navy is the enemy for the Air Force and vice versa. That's what the secrecy is for, and to protect officials from being blamed for errors, from being held accountable, or crimes, or catastrophes, various things, to prevent accountability, in short, to prevent democracy. But then, I don't want to get too abstract here. Let me give you a few examples of what I learned inside the government, because what I learned was, I knew already, yes, they lie a lot. Let me give some examples of the first kind. Start out with the rational example, the legitimate kind. It was one day when I was working for McNaughton early in the morning, just before 8 o'clock, McNaughton ran. He always ran back and forth from McNamara's office down the hall. And he ran in and he said, there's a press conference coming. A Blue Springs drone has just gone down over China. Now, Blue Springs was the code name for a covert set of reconnaissance planes by drones, the kinds we're sending over Iraq right now, rather openly doing that. The Predator drones we have in Afghanistan and so forth. Well, this was a very covert program at that time because we weren't in principle at war with China. Sort of like the U-2 that we'd been doing over Russia. That was a manned plane. This was an unmanned plane. So he says, okay, a Blue Springs drone has just gone down. We have a press conference at 8:30. McNamara says we have 10 minutes to give him 6 alternative lies. So he sat down on one side of the desk, I on the other of his desk in his big office, with yellow pads, and we wrote lies as fast as we could. And we didn't have time to confer with each other, so there was bound to be some overlap. We just wrote as fast. The first couple came very quickly, it was a Chinese nationalist plane. And I remember asking him, by the way, did it have U.S. markings on it? McNaughton writing away said, didn't even look up. He said, who knows? And I said, okay, it was a Chinese nationalist plane. Second, it was a weather plane off course. That was the one used on Powers. That hadn't worked so well on the U-2 because they got Powers alive. And the plane came down and they had the photographs and everything. So that one hadn't turned out well, but it was something to say. And some other things. I don't know. We wrote these things fast. So McNaughton took the list, ran down the hall, came back a few minutes later, and he says, McNamara likes these. He wants 4 more. We have 5 minutes. We have 5 minutes. So I said, why doesn't he say no comment? Because I think the reporters don't like to be lied to, and they understand intelligence operations, and they'll accept that maybe. He says, McNamara won't say no comment. But as he ran out again with our next 4 lies, I can't even remember what they were. They came a little harder, when you got up to about 10. And I said, try it again, see if he won't say no comment. So he came back after the press conference where he was present, and he said, amazingly, he did it. They asked him this question, and he said, no comment. And they seemed to like it. Nobody, and actually a reporter came later and said, into the room and said, tell your boss, assuming it was him who did it, thank him for this morning. It was so much nicer at last, not to be lied to on this point. Well, that's the kind of lie, of course, that supposedly legitimizes the whole system. A more serious kind, actually, had to do with right after August 4th, on September 3rd, a few weeks later, when we were planning, and I could quote here, it's in the book, but writing memos, which I was helping McNaughton on how to provoke further attacks on our ships or our planes or our troops, to which we could respond. In other words, planning two things, to lie to the public about unprovoked attacks to which we had to respond. The Tonkin Gulf situation, I said, as you'll see in the book, had been preceded by covert operations of attacks on North Vietnam of an actually exactly this nature. And actually, what stimulated me to decide that there was enough similarity here to what's going on, the people in the Senate, including people who had voted wrong, who had voted yes on this resolution, still needed some education on. I believe, probably, in my own mind, that the president will not wait till the good weather in late December or January to get on with his war, because public support is eroding for it, the allies are raising resistance and so forth. I think he wants to get in there fast. I actually think it will probably, though not certainly, be before the election. Now that's 2 weeks away, and that poses us a challenge here. If not before the election, if things like the North Korean episode come along that delay things somehow or confuse things, it might be later, and he'll take his chances on getting a Republican Senate. Though I actually think he would want to nail down a Republican Senate by getting the bombing underway before the election. Maybe there's, in my mind, very roughly something like a 30-40% chance for that, and then maybe a 20-30% chance that it would be after the election, but let's say before December, or maybe later. And I think the way it will happen, but that's just my guess, I'll just say how it did happen 38 years ago. When a president wanted to get on with the war, in that case after the election, he was competing with a man calling for escalation, so he did not want to carry out the Goldwater plan before the election, or it would jeopardize his landslide, which is what he got. But after the election, we needed to get on with it. So when that time came, the various plans that had been made for provocation began to be taken out and updated. And what I'm saying is I want our senators, in particular the House will never be consulted on this, to be very critical of what they hear at the last minute about the necessity for bombing, having nothing to do with the congressional resolution, nothing to do with the UN resolution, the president's need as commander-in-chief to respond to or preempt attacks on our boys and girls. On nowadays, I use that phrase because on August 4th, the president was saying to congressmen in his office, there's American boys, in the water as we speak. There is blood in that water. Now, there'd been no attack at all, actually. The 50 caliber bullet was 2 days earlier. There were no bullets and so forth. But he took that act then, later he was planning to take the act, not on the basis, really, of the Tonkin Gulf resolution, nor do I think Bush would do it on the basis of Tonkin Gulf 2, which just got passed. He would do it, I think, probably, my own guess from inside, to protect American soldiers, to preempt, to do something. So how might that happen? My choice to put some of this on the web and not wait for people to buy it was a Doonesbury cartoon, actually, here, of October 19th. I read it in Seattle the other day. This reporter, I forget his name in the strip, says, Ari, he's addressing the president's spokesperson, not Sharon. Ari, could you go over it? It can be hard to tell the difference this month. Ari, could you go over it one more time? Why war with Saddam exactly? He says, I mean, there's no real Al-Qaeda link, as CIA has confirmed. He doesn't have nukes. His army's been decimated, and he hasn't even been able to shoot down a single U.S. jet, despite all this firing which has led to the protective reaction. Isn't there some kind of provocation you can point to? Anything at all? Ari comes back, no, we don't need one. So the other reporter says, maybe our guys should fly slower. And then the first reporter says, "Hey, yeah, like they could cut their engines." And Ari says, "That's it for today." Well, funny, except that the two pages I wanted put on from chapter 4, which they wouldn't let me put the whole chapter on, starts from early September 64, U.S., quote, retaliatory, because we hadn't retaliated. We were planning and had conducted initiative action. Against North Vietnam was a cocked pistol, as it certainly is today as we speak. Officials were waiting for something to retaliate to and increasingly ready to provoke an excuse for attack if necessary. This memo that I quoted from September 3rd went up to the highest levels to provoke a military Hanoi response and to be in a good position to seize on that response to commence U.S. actions against the DRV. That recommendation was accepted and signed by the SecDef, the Secretary of State, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as a recommendation to the President, saying the main further question, well, we should resume the destroyer patrols offshore as close as possible to North Vietnam, resume the covert actuations against North Vietnam, which we'd suspended, not because the President didn't want more of that before the election. But now the election was, when it was over, they said, the main further question is the extent to which we should add elements to the above actions that would tend deliberately to provoke a Hanoi reaction and consequent retaliation by us. Examples of actions to be considered would be running U.S. naval patrols increasingly close to the North Vietnamese coast and or associating them with our covert operations openly, saying, yeah, we're doing it, and, you know, take that. And I then say that I remember well, this is my memory, and this document has not turned up. I very well remember reading the memo by the Joint Staff in response to the question, how can we get this done? Running the destroyer increasingly close to beaching on their coast, U-2 reconnaissance planes over North Vietnam could be supplemented by low-level reconnaissance jets flying progressively lower over populated areas. And so, not slower, but lower. Doonesbury had it wrong there. Actually, faster. The idea was that they proposed to break the sound barrier over Hanoi, causing a sonic boom that would, quote, and I remember these words very clearly, break every window pane in Hanoi. And that ought, you know, to get a rise out of them somehow. Well, all right, the war started. Another incident in the book, the war did get underway, I'm sorry to say, with my help. Not because I thought it was a good thing to do, I thought it was a terrible thing to do. I thought it was even disastrous, and leading the bombing in particular, the bombing. As a former Marine, I have to admit that once the bombing got started, I'm not proud of this, I thought, okay, now the bombing has started, our prestige is at stake, we're in it, we've got to achieve something. I was not so psychologically, subjectively against sending Marines or ground troops, which I thought were at least relevant to the situation there. Okay. That's a bad memory for me, but there I was. So I'm not pointing fingers at other people so much. The question for me that I'm addressing is not how could they, which this country has been asking for 38 years and four more, but what this book addresses is how could we, how could I, how did I come to do this, and then what came of it? 2 years later, I'd been in Vietnam. I had been all over Vietnam evaluating pacification. They are using my Marine training as a former Marine company commander to look at the war up close, as you'll see in some of the pictures here, or the story, which I won't tell here. And I was on a plane with McNamara to brief, actually, Secretary and the new Undersecretary of State Katzenbach on this plane. And as we were coming back from Vietnam, I now, as a foreign service officer, I'd switched over to the State Department, a civilian. McNamara, for whom I'd written speeches earlier, before I went into the Pentagon full time, calls me to the back of the plane, his KC-135, which could fly all the way from Vietnam unrefueled, tanker, windowless tanker. And as we were getting at the end of the trip, he calls me to the back of the plane where he was standing with Bob Comer, an old friend of mine from RAND, some of you may know, who was a former CIA guy now working for the White House on pacification for the White House. So McNamara said, Dan, here's a question you can answer. You're the best person to answer this. Bob here, Bob Comer, says that we're making great progress in Vietnam. And I say things are worse than they were a year ago. What do you say? So I said, well, Mr. Secretary, I would have to say that I'm most impressed at how much the same they are. They were pretty, as a year ago, they were pretty bad then, and they're about the same now. I wouldn't say worse. He said, well, that proves what I said. They're worse. We put another 100,000 troops in there, and they're no better than it was before. He said, that shows the situation is actually worse. So I say, okay. I said, well, that's an interesting way to see it, Mr. Secretary. You could say that. At that moment, a voice comes over the loudspeaker from the pilot's captain saying, gentlemen, please take your seats, fasten your seatbelts, we're coming in for landing. Plane comes in fairly fast at Andrews Air Force Base. It's very foggy. Always remember there's a line of television cameras waiting to be briefed by the Secretary of Defense as he gets off the plane. He's the first one off the plane. I follow, and actually minutes then after we'd had this little exchange with him, I hear him go to the microphones and say, gentlemen, I've just come back from Vietnam. I'm extremely encouraged by all the progress we've seen in every dimension of the war. Things are moving ahead. And I remember listening to this and thinking, wow. I hope I'm not in a position where I have to do that. Actually, I found in picking pictures for this book that there's a picture of that moment that is in the book of McNamara making that statement. That was 66. A year later, I had hepatitis. I would have stayed, but I was leaving. And Bob Comer was coming to take over pacification from the White House. And I was going there to say goodbye to him because I would have stayed there if I didn't have hepatitis and worked for him. But I was leaving. So I'd just gotten out of bed, actually. And I was in the embassy waiting for him to come in so I could shake hands and say goodbye to Bob. And I heard his press conference at Tansanute Airport when he landed. And one minute here. He was saying, and he was known as Blowtorch. He had a very charging manner and all this, and he was very brusque and rather loud when he spoke to the press. But I don't know. And he was saying, I'm terribly excited at the job I'm taking over here. This is going to be wonderful because we're on the way. Victory is in sight. Again, making progress. I was listening to that. Half an hour later, he comes into the embassy, and I could hear him down below, I guess he's on the second floor, and I could hear him saying hello to the secretaries. Ah, great to be here. This is wonderful. This is Bob Comer coming up. He comes into the office, says, Dan, great to see you. Come into the office. And he goes into the office, sits in his desk, lights his pipe, leans back, and says, well, Dan, how's it going? I said, Bob, did you believe what you were saying at the airport? And as I said that, he went like this on the desk. He said, Dan, do you think I'm crazy? And I said, Bob, why did you take this job? And he said, well, that's what my wife keeps asking me. She said you could resign. You could go to a university. You could go back to RAND or something like that. Why are you doing this? And I keep telling her, when the President of the United States says we're in a desperate situation and we need you out there, you just cannot say no to him. I believe, since I've reached the end of my time here, lots more to say. I believe the Pentagon and the CIA are filled at this moment with people who know as well as I knew at that time, and McNaughton knew, and others. McNaughton, who wrote hawk memos throughout the Pentagon Papers, do this, do that, and who believed nothing of what he was writing in top secret memos to the pilot. He was doing it because he worked for McNamara, and I worked for McNaughton. So I understood that. I did the same. And Senator Morse, one of the two men who voted against this in 71. I've just been in Oregon, so I was very happy to pay tribute to him, as to Mark Hatfield in Oregon, told me in 71 when those Herrick cable that I just read to you came out in the Pentagon Papers. It had that one actually had come out in 68. But when all the other documents came out in the Pentagon Papers that had been in my safe, he said, if you'd given us that, if you'd given me that on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1964, in August, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, instead of 5 years later, I gave it to the Senate, and then 7 years later came out in the New York Times. He said, if you'd given me that then, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution would never have gotten out of committee. And if it had, by some chance, it would have been defeated on the floor. Well, I thought at the time, I know it's over time here, but take two more minutes, I'm sorry. I thought at the time, that's a little overstated, because the president wanted to get into the war. I knew already, and it's certainly true, it's very, very hard to keep a president who wants to get into a war from having his war. And very hard to stop it once he gets in. Very hard. So the time to do it is before he gets in, but it's not easy. One cable, a few cables, would not have done it. Despite, so there's no Tonkin Gulf Resolution then. It would have come later under a different provocation, or he would have gone without a Tonkin Gulf Resolution. And then years later, it came to me, wait a minute. If I had taken the whole contents of my safe, or one drawer of it, and given that to Congress, or put it out, in the fall of 64, showing that everything the president was saying during the campaign was false, and that the estimates he was getting indicated that this was an unnecessary war, ghastly, dangerous, highly bloody, I don't believe the war would have occurred. I could have done that. 100 other people could have done that. McNamara could have done that. Of course, none of us thought of doing it. And the reason I was using the last bit of my voice, which has now come back, in the last week, I lost it here in Berkeley, here at a fundraiser for Barbara Lee, which I was a good cause to do it. And some of you may have heard me that night croaking away and losing my voice talking about Mordecai Vanunu. The greatest prophet and whistleblower of the nuclear era, I would say, has been in prison for 16 years. I've wanted to say, and I've said on every occasion now, if you know anybody in the government, or if you have any way to get through them, but especially when I'm in Washington, I've been, and elsewhere where I can speak directly on the radio to people who listen to this, if you know that the president is now lying us into a recklessly dangerous and unnecessary, a wrongful war in Iraq, then I urge you to consider doing what I wish I had done in 1964-65. Go to Congress and the press and tell the truth with documents. It will, in fact, be at risk to your career, even if you do it anonymously. All the more if it's traceable to you, all the more if you do it in open testimony, which is the most effective way to do it. Scott Ritter is doing everything he could as a former official. He is definitely a new hero of mine, and he is doing whatever. But an official could do that. Senators could be holding hearings right now, and in my opinion, you should tell your senators, both Feinstein, who voted wrong on this and who does not know something that her colleague Senator Boxer does not know. Boxer is on the Intelligence Committee and understands perfectly well that this is a wrongful war. Boxer should be told she did the right thing and we're behind her. Feinstein should be told, get right or we will work against you in primaries. We will give our contributions to your rivals. We will work for your rivals. And we will do our best. We will do our best to fire you on this. But the good news is the truth that not only senators and officials can tell, but the truth that each of us knows in one capacity or another, of the wrongfulness of the war, or in aside from the war, your corporate involvements your church involvements, as we're seeing with the Catholic Church. All of those, truth-telling is always risky and can be worth it because it can save a lot of lives. So it is worth taking the risk. Thank you for being here.